You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello! Connecting the dots here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today, as we are here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And we're here on now, it's the second time that we have had,
No, it's Mrs., but I go by Hey You. I'm good with that.
Okay. Sherry Antonetti. Sherry Antonetti is my new Monday co-host. She is a Catholic freelance writer, blogger, mom to six girls and four boys. She has written for Alatea, one of the numerous Catholic websites with difficult to pronounce names. There's something about
I didn't even know how that was pronounced.
Yeah, wow. It's like, you know, there was a long debate. I started writing for Pathos a while back.
And Pathos, there was like this, you mean? Pathos, right?
See, there you go.
Yes.
And it's like this, it's like this, this big, long debate for a long time is, how is this pronounced? Is it Pathos or Pathos? I suggested Wingardium Leviosa, but
there you like are. That.
And well, anyway.
It's Pat Eos.
That's right.
No, Pat Heos.
Yes, that's right. There you go.
Pat, he owes me. Yeah.
By the way, what's Irish and sits outside all day?
I'm dying. No.
Patio furniture.
Oh.
Furniture. That's a really funny joke, and you're laughing inside. She also writes for the Catholic Standard. We're still talking about Sherry Antonetti here. Catholic Digest, Catholic Mom, the National Catholic Register. And in addition to columns, she has contributed to the book Big Hearted, Voices of Autism, and the Catholic Mom's Prayer Companion. And she's penned her first historical fiction, The Book of Helen, in which she's not carpooling and problem-solving homework for her kids and sorting socks. She's doing other things like talking on the radio with me here. And want to welcome Sherry Antonetti.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And in addition to Sherry, we also have another guest here. We've got Regina Doman. She is a Catholic wife and mother and author. And man, is she an author. She has written a ton of stuff and editor. She currently runs her own company, which I am happy to report is called Chesterton Press.
I love that.
Well done. Publishes and distributes quality Catholic fiction. Regina and her husband, Andrew, live in the Shenandoah Valley out there in Virginia. By the way, I flew over the Shenandoah Valley with a friend of mine a couple of years ago. He's a small plane pilot. We took off from somewhere near Manassas. Flew out over the Shenandoah, took a couple of loops over Christendom College. It was really gorgeous, I got to say. So anyway.
It is one of the most beautiful places in America as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, I'm really lucky.
Yeah. She lives on a farmstead with 9 of their 10 children. And one of the questions that we'll look at is how do you get it all done?
Oh, I don't.
What makes you think I get it all done? Oh, no.
I never get it all done. That's, you know, goes without saying. Anybody to be, yeah, anybody should know that. Yeah.
Not the goal.
So anyway, welcome to both Regina and Sherry Antonetti. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call because we're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you are welcome to join us. You can also give us a call, or you can also, I'm sorry, tweet us at Breadbox Media.
Cool.
So, So I figured, you know, we're all writers.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
we could. I think probably talk a little bit about the writing life.
Sure.
I got to say, the most valuable class I ever took in high school, hands down, was typing.
Yes.
It really is. I mean, of all the classes that I took, I'm sure there are other things that I took that were important, but typing has been my life. I'm just typing stuff. So,
That's funny, because for me, my typing class really did diddly squat, as did most of my high school classes. I'd have to say that in the end, it was theology that actually did a lot more for me. Okay. You know, my typing, I only learned to type when I got hired as an assistant editor, and I had one of my bosses insisted on dictating everything, and he expected me to know how to type. And so that's where I learned to type, because he was wonderful and brilliant and terrifying, and I didn't want to tell him that I was a lousy typist, so I very quickly learned to type.
Well, yep. That's motivation, fear.
Yep, that's motivation, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, so, well, I thought I would we'd spend a little time talking about Regina's really prolific output.
Yes.
So how did you wind up becoming a writer, Regina?
Oh, gosh. In a backwards sort of way. I sort of intended to be a writer, but not the kind of writing I do, if that means anything.
Okay.
When I was a child, I was obsessed by the theater, and I just knew beyond any doubt that I wanted to write plays. I wanted to write scripts. I was going to write movies, and that was what I was going to do. I wanted to be a script writer.
Okay.
So I went to Franciscan University of Steubenville, and that's actually where the theology classes I took that really impacted me. I took there because, of course, when you go to Franciscan, they make you take all that stuff. And
yes.
My Catholic education had been kind of spotty, like most of us who grew up in the 70s.
Okay.
And, yeah, I had some goods, had some bad, had some heresy, you know, had some fluff. And had some really good teaching from Protestants, actually, from my Protestant friends. But
okay.
Franciscan was really where that connected the dots for me, you know, the different professors there. But they had a very excellent program in television production, so I joined the communications department there. But
okay.
my academic advisor was in journalism. And the entire time, he kept on saying to me, you should be in journalism. You should be in journalism. You know, Regina, you really should be in journalism. And I didn't listen.
Okay.
So then I graduated with my degree in television production and theater arts, and I went out and I got a job in, you guessed it, journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been in journalism in one form or another ever since.
Wow.
So, I basically have been, I've been working in Catholic publishing for most of my professional life. I've been a freelance editor, I've been an assistant editor. For my own company, I'm the main editor. I've been acquisitions editor. So, yeah, I've pretty much – and I've also freelanced for a number of Catholic publications. But after a while, I figured I had to either write articles or write books, and I decided I should write books. So I've stopped freelancing for newspapers and Catholic publications, but I miss it because I really enjoyed that time of being able to do that. And I definitely enjoyed all the Catholic professionals, all the people in the writing world that I met when I was doing that, and still enjoy those relationships.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it's funny how different, you know, you wind up in different ways.
Yeah.
Getting into it. I got an ink. I didn't realize that you were also interested in theater. That was originally what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm. Because
I was young and dumb. I did a play in high school, and that whet my appetite. And then when I got into college, I went to a play.
Uh-huh.
and I came out of that just going, I have to audition for the next play. This is at a community college that I went to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I said, I just got to do this. And so I did, and it really saved my life.
What was the play?
The play was something called Bullshot Crummond. Which was a spoof of Bulldog Drummond and the sort of stock film characters that were, kind of how this was done in the 30s, right? So you had a couple of main actors playing the hero and the heroine and so forth. And then you had this sort of stock company that kept turning up over and over again as, you know, the guy would be the mad scientist in one film, and then the German guard in the next one, and then the stuffy butler in the one after that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this play was like that, and what they did was they had one guy play the mad scientist and the stuffy
yeah.
waiter and the hero's friend and all the other things. And I tried out for the play, and I landed that part.
Wow.
And it was so fun doing that. Oh, it was just a blast doing that. And so I got into theater, and it was at a time in my life when I really needed that. It was I was pretty depressed at that point mm-hmm. in my life. So anyway,
that's interesting. Yeah, that also mirrors my experience, but go on. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that, and then, went off to college and did the whole thing. And eventually realized that theater was just not going to, I was never going to make it as in theater.
Yeah.
So.
I love that both of you were interested in theater. I always loved theater. I just can't sing. And so that was never in the cards. Although I was always in the chorus because they needed filler.
No, that's well, sure. And Mark, both I have to say, my interest in the theater was only from a directing script writing standpoint. I'm a lousy actor. I know because I grew up with great actors and great singers, and I'm a lousy actor and singer. I never was interested for a performance. I wanted to create the content, and I wanted to direct. Like that was where I always saw myself. And to this day, I've people who know me well have known this. Like if I am directing a play or something like that, I'm like, this is what I was created to do.
That's really cool.
It's very clear to me that that's like the most worthwhile time I've ever spent in my life has been directing plays.
Well, we will we will continue this conversation right after the break. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Sherry Antonetti and Regina Dolan. And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm Shane, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti.
Hello.
And we're also here today with Regina Doman.
Hello.
Hello. And we're talking a little bit about the writing life. People, come into the writing life in different ways. Some people, I was saying over the break, some people are like, when they're 6 years old, they know, I will be a writer. Yeah, and then there are other people like me who are like, I have no plan. When I was in high school, they would give you the life preparedness tests or what, I don't know what they're called, see yourself in 5 years? And I was like, I don't have the slightest idea where I'm going to be in 5 years. I just didn't have a clue. So, when I got out of school, I was like gonna do theater, but then reality hit me in the face at some point in college. I said, theater's not gonna happen. Then I dropped out of school for a while, and so I wound up working at a J.K. Gill. I don't even know if you guys know what a J.K. Gill is, but it's like a store in a mall, basically.
Cool.
So I did.
Okay.
I was a mall rat for a while, and then went back to school so that I could finish my English degree. I switched my degree to English. So, because it was like, that's a degree in a thing. And I don't know what I'm going to do. So I went back to work, and I worked at the University of Washington for a good long while, putting that typing class to work. And so just did that for a while. And then started kind of scribbling stuff, like shortly after, really, and I've always chalked it up to this, right after I was received into the church. I'd always been a scribbler, but right after I was received into the church and I was confirmed, and I'm convinced it was the sacrament of confirmation that did it, I just started writing stuff about the faith.
Cool.
And partly just to kind of get my own thoughts in order. So I started a letter to Peter Kraft.
Oh, wow.
And that letter turned out to be the manuscript of a book that I wrote called This Is My Body. And anyway,
wound up publishing stuff.
And mostly it was I realized I'm interested in this. And amazingly, editors were interested in it. And since I was a new father with a couple of kids and they were paying me stuff for the stuff that I wrote, I thought, well, I'll just keep doing this.
Wow.
Well, but it was really awesome. Like there was no plan.
Right.
I will do this. This is my life's work. It was just people seem to like it, and I'm getting enough money that I can feed my kids, so this is an equitable arrangement.
It's a good thing.
And so I'm curious, Sherry, I mean, how did you wind up becoming a writer?
Well, I'll say that some people saw something in me that I could write because my high school principal ran the paper, and she tapped me for her elite journalism class. There were only a few people chosen, and I was quite shocked when she decided I should be in it. I wanted to be considered an intellectual. I was always on the not quite cool enough to be the cool kids pack. And so I thought being an English major would make me sound intellectual. That's very superficial, but there it is. And so I was an English major for college, and I'm naturally stubborn, so I stuck through with it all the way through, at which point I didn't know what I was going to do when I got done. But I had been volunteering in a special needs group, so I decided to apply for a master's in English 5 places and special ed in 1, and I only got into the special ed. So I thought, fine, I'll be a special educator. And then 3 years later, I'd been married, I have a son, and I stopped working, and I thought, well, what do I do now? And that's always a fun question with God.
Yeah. And it's true. It's very true. Yeah.
And so I started, I had multiple children before I figured out that I could write. But at that point, the first piece that I sold ever was to the Washington Post.
Oh my goodness.
It was a humor piece. Railing on the fact that I had to go replace my cell phone. But
now, I just want to know something. What does the Washington Post pay? I'm asking for a friend.
For a friend. Well, you have to wait about a year for your piece to run.
Okay.
And then you get about $150.
Okay. Cool. All right.
So I was happy.
For how many words?
I don't remember that first piece how much it was, but it covered a page, so I was cool. I was cool with me.
All right. Yeah.
And then I wrote a second piece, and they took that one. So I was like, "Whoa, you know, I'm cool stuff." And then I started writing for the local Catholic paper, which was the Catholic Standard.
Okay.
And that's kind of how I fell into this, and I thought I can do this. Mm. And so I always called myself the dog that caught the car.
That's awesome.
You know? Okay.
So that's how I started writing all that. And then I thought, you know, important writers, they write books. You know, they write books. So that's why I started writing the Book of Helen, was so I could do something important.
Okay. So you launched right into fiction.
Yes. Yes. Well, I love Greek myth tremendously. And I was stuck at the hospital with my my daughter, who was 6 weeks old and had RSV. And I was reading the Odyssey and pestering the doctors. And so between bugging them on their rounds to help my daughter and worrying about her, I decided to write the first chapter of the Book of Helen about Helen of Troy at 65 starting over. And I had so much fun, I kept going.
Okay.
So
that's pretty awesome.
I am totally with Malibu Barbie when it comes to fiction. Fiction is hard. And I've written very little of it. I've written little things here and there, but my hat is off to both of you. And I got to tell you, Regina, I look at your output and I just go, where does all that come from? How do you make all that stuff up?
It's tremendous.
Thank you. It's kind of deceptive, though. I realize that because I discovered early on when I had like a nonfiction gig, like somebody gave me like a nice column written. I was doing a website for Catholics and Protestants, which is like my favorite group to write for, and I could not do it. I could not do a monthly column, and I realized that, like, and I was able to do whatever I wanted. You know, I mean, I really, like, I didn't even have, they didn't pick the topics or anything, and I could not do it. And I was like, wow, it takes a certain type of person to do, like, regular output. And the thing is that it takes so long for me to write anything that, like, basically I'm able to kind of publish a couple years. Like, so the stuff that's going into print is stuff I wrote a couple years ago. So it kind of looks as though I'm doing it all the time and, you know, I'm highly productive, but that's actually just because of how it happens to come out. Because generally speaking, it takes a long time for me to sell anything as well. So over the years, it kind of accumulates and it looks kind of impressive. But you guys, like, I'm actually in awe of somebody like you that seems to put out, like, tons and tons of stuff. Like, people who can do, like, 3 books in 5 years, I'm like, wow, my mind does not work that fast.
Well, see, the easy thing about here's the thing.
Yeah.
The secret about being a Catholic writer.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know this.
Nonfiction writer. I will tell you the secret. The great thing about being a Catholic nonfiction writer is that you can plagiarize and call it being faithful to the tradition, because that's all you're doing. You know, the thing about being a nonfiction Catholic writer is you're absolutely not making anything up. You're not supposed to make anything up. You're supposed, all you have to do is
like
just, all you're really doing is you're just communicating what somebody has already said. You're doing it a little different way.
Right.
Oh, you're translating it into in my case, evangelicalese, because that's who I was writing to, was that audience.
Yeah.
But I totally, the whole goal of being a Catholic nonfiction writer is to not make anything up.
Wow.
And so extremely easy for me to write. That's hard. That's super
I want to ask Regina what she thinks the goal is of writing Catholic fiction, because that's a good segue.
It depends on how you define Catholic fiction, and we could take 2 hours to try and define it. But I'll tell you how I define it, okay?
Go for it.
And you don't have to accept my definition, but this is kind of how I define it for, you know.
It's going to be a quiz on this later, so.
Yeah, Catholic fiction, like, I'm calling it Catholic genre fiction, which is defined as Catholics. Fiction that is written by Catholics for a Catholic audience to be distributed in Catholic, standard Catholic channels, really. Because, I mean, if you're going to talk about Catholic fiction as, like, Lord of the Rings or Flannery O'Connor, or, I mean, you can make a really good case that Fiddler on the Roof is Catholic fiction. I mean, and that was obviously not, you know, written by a Catholic or for a Catholic audience. But, yeah, it resonates, it speaks to things, but yet it doesn't fulfill the, you know, it could be Catholic fiction if you want to define it very broadly as something that speaks to the good, the true, and the beautiful. But most of the time, I realize when people are talking about Catholic fiction, you know, such as in, why is there no Catholic fiction? Well, Lord of the Rings is Catholic fiction, and, you know, Flannery O'Connor and all these other people. And then you're like, well, actually, that's not Catholic fiction, according to how a publisher would understand it. So
that's true.
And so I'm kind of really looking at it from a professional point of view, which is in terms of market, audience, producers. You know, that's
right.
And that's not very exciting, to tell the truth.
I mean,
it is a useful and workable definition, you know, if you argue about Catholic fiction. So.
Okay. Well, we're up against a break, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti and Regina Doman. And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello! And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Sherry Antonetti, my Monday co-host, and Regina Doman, who is our special guest today. Regina Doman is the author of, well, I'm going to go ahead and just ask you, what you've written a bunch of books. I think all of us authors do this. Your books are like your children.
Yes, they are.
You're not supposed to have favorites, but sometimes you do.
Yeah.
And there are books that I have that I'm really super proud of, and there are other books that are like, I don't hate this book, but I like this other book better.
Yeah.
Do you have favorite books?
Well, I do. I mean, I do tend to like whatever I'm working on the best. Although my current novel that I've been complaining about on Facebook in very secretive sort of terms has been, right now I'm at the point where I really hate the book. Not really hate it, but I'm like frustrated by it. But that's okay, because I've been working on it. I've been trying to like bang my head against it for 3 years, and I might be making a breakthrough, so that's pretty exciting. So just kind of like with the child, sometimes you're like, I love this child, but right now they're driving me nuts, and I just can't wait for their hormones to settle down, or for them to get through this phase, or to learn that I really, that some things really can't be changed just by screaming and yelling, and then you like them a little better once you get through it. So that's kind of how it is with manuscripts, isn't it?
Yep.
Absolutely.
So
by the way, I'm just gonna throw this out there. I don't know if anybody's ever said this to you before, but as we're talking here on the air, Regina and I have met face to face, but for some reason it didn't stick out to me until now, as it's just your voice. But for some reason, you sound a lot like Rosie O'Donnell.
Funny.
I don't know what that means, but
well, you know what? I don't have a television, and so I know who Rosie O'Donnell is because, as a communication major, I must know who all the major public figures are. I have never heard her talk, so
sound a lot like her, but for some reason there are Rosie O'Donnell redolences in your voice. That's a word.
Okay, well, there you are.
So there you go. Something to think about.
Yeah.
But you're talking about this roadblock, that you're hitting.
The
novel. Part of the reason I wanted to do this show today is because I know there are a certain percentage of people out there right now who are aspiring writers. They're thinking about being a writer. There are certain things that I always tell people who are wanting. I get, and you probably get this too, emails from people saying, I'd like to be a writer. What do I do?
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
of course.
And the first thing that I always tell people who want to get into writing is write about what interests you and nothing else. Yes. Don't write about things that bore you, because when you do, it will come through writing.
Yes.
You'll sound bored. But if you write about what interests you, a lot of times the ink just flows. I mean, I have a passion about this, and I got to tell the world. So that's the first thing I tell people. The other thing I always tell people is don't worry about rejection letters. The first thing that you can assume as a writer is you're going to get rejection letters. They're just part of your stripes. They're just the badge of honor that you bear like every other writer. It is not a judgment from the universe on you. It just, you'll get a rejection letter sometimes, and that's going to happen, but it doesn't mean that you're a failure. Because the other thing, of course, that you'll get is you're also going to get acceptance letters. There are going to be people who are going to say, this is really interesting. And for periodicals, the great thing about writing for periodicals, of course, is that periodicals are gigantic vacuum cleaner moths that are always sucking
searching
up
for stuff, copies. Right? That's true.
Yes, we love them.
New writers all the time.
That's very true.
Thank you.
So, keep going. And if you get a rejection letter, it doesn't mean anything. Go back, look your piece over. Maybe it was just the wrong periodical.
Yeah.
I wrote this, here's the interesting thing that I wrote on the biblical use of names. And I sent it to Catholic Mom Zine. Catholic moms are like, we don't care about this. Well, okay. But Catholic aunts are interested in this,
Yeah.
And so that's the advice that I give to aspiring writers is follow those simple sorts of rules.
That's fairly sound. Go on.
Oh, I was just thinking, do you guys have advice that you give to aspiring writers?
Sherry, you first.
Okay. Know your ending. At least have an idea of how you want the book to end.
Yes.
Absolutely. Because if you don't, you can't get there.
Yes. I can't write without the ending, really. It's just, yeah. Getting to the ending, like knowing the beginning and knowing the ending is actually often a real problem for me. But yeah, knowing the ending, I can't write without the ending. I'm not one of those exploratory writers. I just can't do it. I need to know how it ends. Okay. Otherwise, I can't start writing. Like, that's part of an important component in the process for me.
Okay.
I would say for my advice to writers is I usually say the element of discipline in the habit of writing cannot be too overemphasized. And actually, a lot of times I'm asked by parents to give advice for their, you know, their homeschool parents or their, you know, parents who just have a writing child and they want to know what to say. I say, make them finish their homework. Make them do their math. Because I said, really, the single most thing I'm glad about, like I, you know, is that I went to a strict Catholic school and I was forced to do things I did not like to do. And because that habit of writing is just so important, because especially when you're writing a novel, really the world does not care about your novel. The world does not know that your novel is any good. So in the middle of the night, you know, 10 years from now, no one is going to be sitting there saying, finish your novel. You know, the only person who can make you finish your novel is you. Because by that time, even your spouse and your kids will be sick of the novel.
Yes.
You know, at 4 a.m, you will be sick of that novel and you won't want to, you know, stay there. You know, right now I am kind of writing at 4 a.m because that's like the sweet spot for me is getting up at 4 and I can write for 2 hours before the first email comes in. Right. And, you know, it's working for me. It's a secret I gladly learned from Susie Lloyd, who did the same thing.
Okay.
You know, really, so that self-discipline, I just cannot emphasize that enough, that you need to do that. And also, since we're talking about Catholic writing, I said, if you think you have a talent for writing or you want to write or you feel that call or however you want to spiritualize it or not spiritualize it, I said, regardless, give that talent to God. I was like, if you're a Catholic, take your laptop, take your journal, go into the Eucharistic chapel and just plop it right down there before God and say, God, I'm just going to give you this talent and you just do what you want with it, you know, just so long as I can be faithful to you. I said, I really think that that's important, you know, to dedicate that, because so much of our writing is bound up with our psyche. It's bound up with our temptations. It's bound up with our weaknesses and our temptations. You know, and I said, I want my writing to ultimately make me a better, loving, more compassionate, holier person, and not to make me a self-interested egotist, you know? I mean, really, we have to remember what this is all about in the grand thing scheme of things. If I'm a brilliant writer and I hate my neighbor, you know, I mean, it's not, I like to think God might cut me a break if I created a beautiful masterwork of, you know, of the beauty of Catholicism. But if I was a jerk to my husband and kids and the next door neighbor and, you know, my online friends, you know, I can't see it's going to do me much good. So, yeah. I don't, that's the most important thing.
No, and that's really true. I mean, speaking as a practicing jerk.
Hey, you're also a practicing jerk. That's awesome.
Well, you know, but it's but it is true. Is you can, and I've done it. You know, you can use the gifts that God gives you in ways that God doesn't want you to use them, and that's bad. But at the same time, you know, one of the things that somebody once pointed out to me is that cars are easier to turn when they're in motion.
Yep.
So it's better to get going on something than to kind of just always be ruminating but never beginning.
I had a great teacher about writing that said that, you know, poems are never finished, they're only abandoned. And he felt that was true about works as well. I'm done now with this. And that's what you have to do. And that's, you know, and I love your point about giving it to God, because it's such a rush when you get a yes or an acceptance letter or it's been published. And that's where having friends and family really make a difference, because I published today and the kids are like, okay.
You know? And another thing, you know, that can often be very, very helpful is having somebody who's a sounding board. I certainly have done this many times. You know, my wife is often my sounding board. I'll sit down and often reading something aloud, you hear those clunkers you didn't hear when you were just writing it.
Yeah.
Or you'll see, you know, wait, there's a pretty serious gap in this argument here that I just didn't notice until I read it aloud. And so having somebody you can bounce things off can be really useful. I often, do you find that you write with, I have imaginary readers in my head that I'm talking to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I was going to say, for me, my degree is in communication. And so, like, I don't have a degree in English literature. You know, I'm really not, even don't consider myself an artist. I consider myself a professional, you know, on some level. And so one of the things is communication. Like, the first question you always ask is, who's the audience? Who's this for? So, yeah, I do. I actually try to have a very specific audience, you know, a welcoming audience. You know, I always imagine them as really liking what I have to say or being wooed by what I have to say if they don't. You know, if they didn't know that they want to hear me say it, I'm wooing them to hear, you know, so that they want to hear them say it. And I think that's important. You know, I think it's William Carlos Williams said, he said, I do not. Now, he had a different view. He said, I do not write for myself. I do not write for the masses. He said, I write for myself. I write for my friends and I write to ease the passing of time. And what I took away from that is I do write for myself and to ease the passing of time because I have to. But I'm from friends, and that's the best audience you can have.
We will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Sherry Antonetti and Regina Doman. We'll be back on Redbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti and Regina Doman. And, we were talking over the break, and I just discovered that your Chesterton Press, which I must just once again, let me commend you on Chesterton Press. That's just so great. Your Chesterton Press carries some of the work by Ben Hatke. I love Ben Hatke.
Oh, my gosh. It's very difficult not to like Ben Hatke.
He's just lovely.
He is the most naturally talented artist I have ever met in my life.
Yeah.
Like, when I met him first, he was in college at Christom College, which is in my town. And he had very little training at that point, but he was still so incredible as an artist. I had him as a spec artist doing he was doing illustrations for a spec project that I was working at the time as an editor that did not go through. But I have all these lovely illustrations by him. And so I was like, you are really good. I would love to find a project for you to work on. And the first project I found for him to work on was Angel in the Waters, my first picture book. Oh, okay.
Which is gorgeous. Okay. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. Yes. And he and I became friends when his wife, he married Anna Bertolini, who is one of my best friends. And they live down the street from us. So, and I actually just read Mighty Jack this past weekend, his new graphic novel, which I am still geeking out over because it's so good. And we're carrying it to Chesterton Press. Yeah.
My son and his little girl are big fans of...
Really?
Zeta the Space Girl. Big fan.
Oh, yes.
Space Girl.
And, Anna is, if you're a Zeta the Space Girl geek, you know you've read book three, and you know that Anna was the original inspiration for Zeta the Space Girl. I have seen Anna in her Zeta the Space Girl costume at, like, the Christendom dances and stuff. She actually had a Zeta the Space Girl and basically Ben wrote the comics to impress her. And I have... I have the original Zeta the Space Girl comic. It is locked in a box in my in one of my storage spaces. And when I am 90 years old, I will auction it off for hopefully a very hefty sum, which I will then bestow upon my deserving children.
Okay.
So,
love it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Fantastic. Oh, I'm just so tickled. If you're out there in radio land and you have not run across Ben Hatke, H A T K E.
Yes.
Just rush right out and get anything that Ben Hatke has ever done, and you'll be a happy person.
You will. You will be a happier person. And you can find a lot of it. Not all of it. You can find a lot of it at ChestertonPress.com.
Yeah. Yes. You know, which reminds me, by the way, because when you talk about literature,
yes,
people have this notion that literature is something different than reading for fun.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the first the first thing that literature does, if it's decent at all, is it's enjoyable to read.
It entertains.
That's what it does. That's what literature is for. It's a story to entertain you. If it's not entertaining, it's like comedy. I mean, the first rule of comedy is it has to be funny. It can be all kinds of other things after that.
But it has to be
funny.
It's, and if I can actually, Mark, if I can mention a pet peeve here as a professional Catholic writer or whatever, occasionally, I have somebody who I do a lot of work in the Catholic world. I sell to a lot of Catholic parents and, trying to help them find good Catholic books for their kids. That's part of my mission. But every once in a while, somebody will come out with something that is like a little bit pushing the envelope. And, maybe it's something that has nudity in it. Maybe it's something that has curse words. Actually, curse words is usually the thing. And then, they put this out. And the book or the show or the film doesn't do really well with Catholic audiences. And then usually the very indignant Catholic author gets up there and gripes about how Puritan Catholic audiences are or Christian audiences or whatever. And I was like, hey, look, all you're really saying is that they did not find your work entertaining. They are not entertained by work that is profane, that is obscene, that has cuss words in it. I was like, it actually has nothing to do with Puritanism. They just don't find it entertaining. I said, now, it would be different if you were trying to make a point, like if you were trying to do an expose on kids who are abused in the sex trade industry and your work necessarily involved a lot of upsetting, then I think you'd have a point. But if all you produced is an entertainment, and if people are not entertained by your entertainment, well, I'm sorry, but that's your problem. And it's really not the audience's problem. If they
people
don't
do not appreciate my genius.
Exactly.
That's tough.
Yeah, exactly. I said, well, if you're in the business of entertaining, I said, you are on the level with the guy out there on the, on the streets of D.C. with a guitar and a hat in front of him, and you are playing a song. And if people don't like your song, they don't have to stop and give you money. It's just how the game works.
Thank you.
That's how it works. And that is the story of fiction. Yeah.
it is very true.
Forget it.
And in this day and age, there's so many ways that you can be entertained that if you don't catch them in the first few sentences.
No, you
got to. Yeah, you're done.
Yep. It's
one other thing that I think is worth pointing out, though, is when we use the word entertained.
Yes.
That doesn't mean it has to be fluffy. King Lear was written as entertainment. King Lear is just, it'll tear your guts out, it's a sad story, When we say entertaining, it doesn't have to mean fluff brained, and it doesn't have to mean easy either. No. I mean, part of,
Go ahead.
The mark of entertainment is not everything has to be Star Wars. Star Wars is entertaining, but so is Hamlet.
Yes. And you have to notice, though, that even the great, Hamlet's a great example. Mm-hmm. Even the great works of literature that go to a really heavy, really deep, really dark place start out like they still woo you. Hamlet starts out with a ghost story. Did we see a ghost or did we not? And the audience is like, and then they, they're wooed into it. And that's no matter how deep you plan to go, you still have to woo the audience. You still have to do that. Exactly. And it's amazing when you read the great works of literature, how they do woo you. They really took that part of it very seriously.
Yeah. I had a science fiction writer, John C. Wright, remarked one time that, what you're doing when you're writing fiction is you're casting a spell.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think that is a really nice, that is what you're doing. You're bringing people into a world, and it could be a preposterous world. Mm-hmm. If you step out of that world, but while you're in it, it all makes sense.
That's the one thing. Yeah. One of the reasons why, you know, mentioning Hamlet and King Lear, I tell this. I'm teaching high school English, which is awesome. I kind of got into it to make money, but I just love teaching these kids. And I've never really broken open English literature, being the television person that I am. So I'm kind of learning right there along with the kids. And I say, you know, Americans, we are really weird. We are really unlike the rest of the world in that we do not appreciate tragedy. I mean, we like our stories happy. We like happy endings, and we don't like to hear about suffering. I said, in that way, we are very strange, because the rest of the world, an important component of fiction was really to help people make sense of tragedy, you know, as captured by what Tom Clancy said, which he said, what's the difference between fiction and real life? Fiction has to make sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fiction has to make sense. And that was what people throughout every history and culture, people called upon fiction to help them make sense out of tragedy, which is why we have so many great works of literature that don't end happily, because people want to make sense of, you know, when bad things happen. And great works of literature do that so amazingly, beautifully.
There's a terrific book by Frederick Buechner, the name of which eludes me. But the subtitle is The Gospel as Comedy, Tragedy, and Fairy Tale.
Oh, I love it. Okay.
And he makes the argument that the gospel fits all of those categories, depending on
how we're looking at it.
Telling the truth. That's it. And I always think of, you know, one of the things that Mel Brooks said one time is he said, tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall into a sewer and die. And it really is true. A lot of it depends. You know, Hamlet, if you just change it a little bit, Hamlet could be hilarious.
Absolutely.
Oh, it is hilarious.
And it is the subject of so many comic sketches and all the rest of it. The gospel has those elements to it as well. And this is something that Tolkien got, was above all, that the gospel is structured like a fairy tale. It begins in joy, and it reaches just an absolute black pit of tragedy,
mm-hmm.
but then has that turn that a fairy tale has. That
the
ends
catastrophe
breaks open.
The Eucatastrophe, exactly.
Yeah, and, I love it.
I am so happy that you've written fairy tales.
Oh, thank
Me
you.
Too.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's kind of like what I have my. That's how I got into the writing. The thing that I wrote that happened to get published first, and like you, it was kind of a matter of, oh well, people like this, you know, what happened to be a fairy tale that was retold, you know, in a modern setting with Catholic characters and themes, and that's how I got into the gig I got into.
Yeah, yeah, and it's so good. You know, you can write the kinds of books that I do that very few people will read because they're nonfiction. What people love, and people have always loved better, is fiction. They like stories, and rightly so. Jesus doesn't give, Jesus never gives a homily on justification by faith alone.
Yeah,
he gives
give
us the story. Yeah, he gives us the parable of the prodigal son.
Yeah.
And so the story is so crucial.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, story, being a Catholic, it's crazy to realize, and you can correct me if I'm not saying this right, but story precedes theology. I realized this when we were having a theological discussion, that one of my sisters said, well, what is the church's doctrine on this? And I said, well, you have to realize where the church gets her doctrine from. I said, basically, Jesus didn't come down here and give us doctrine per se. He did things, and the church meditates on the stuff that he did. And that's where our theology comes from. From a story.
Yes. Hey!
In the beginning.
Regina Doman, Sherry Antonetti, I want to thank you both so much. This was oodles of fun. We're going to have you back, Regina.
Absolutely.
Our producer today was Jenna Jawa Longworth, and I have been your host, Mark Shea. I will be back tomorrow with Michael Hitchens here on Connecting the Dots. Till then, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.